Yep, my name's Tim Prouty. I work for Isilon Systems. And I'm going to give a talk on becoming a Samba developer, which doesn't necessarily mean Samba team member. In this case, it happens to. But really, it's going to be looking at kind of the similar things that Steven went over in his talk about the merge we just did and pushing all of our code upstream. But rather than focusing on the technical details, I'm actually going to focus on kind of the reasons behind it, the motivation, and kind of where we're going from here. So a question I'd like to kind of explore throughout this talk is, why is it beneficial to become an active developer in the Samba community rather than just a consumer of free software? So a quick overview. Real briefly, we'll touch on what Isilon is, look at our history with Samba, the new philosophy going forward, actually moving to that new model and realizing the philosophy, our, hopefully, final merge, and then going forward. So Isilon, we're a software company. We sell hardware. I'm not going to go into the details too much, but we're clustered storage. We have a fully symmetric architecture. It gives us high performance, scalability, all that kind of stuff. Steven really did a good job of explaining it. But I will throw in this nice marketing slide. So what this actually allows us to do is have a file come in over the front end network, and the cluster will actually take the file and stripe it across the cluster. Very much like RAID, except we're striping across the cluster instead of an array of disks. And what you see here is you get the parity blocks as well as the file data blocks striped. So that allows you to have nodes or disks in a node go down. Likewise, when you want to read the file back, it can be reassembled on any node in the cluster which has a coherent view of the file system and is then sent back across the wire.
So, our history with Samba.
So, Isilon was a startup founded back in 2001. And we started using Samba because, it's free software. We're on FreeBSD. We can plug it in and it works. And now we have SIFS. Our customers were primarily interested in NFS back then. So, our level of SIFS support was not all that important. People were happy to have it, but it was not really a requirement. We started with Samba 2.x. I don't remember exactly what that X was, because I wasn't there at the time. But over time, the demand for SIFS grew, which kind of brings us to where we are today. But looking back a little, what happened was we started to target the enterprise, and as we got more and more enterprise customers, they became larger and started having larger SIFS requirements as well. One of the biggest things, we were on a cluster, so cluster coherent locking was one of the first important pieces for us. Now this requirement came a few years before CTDBs came around, so we kind of had to start working on our own system and developed our own cluster coherent locks. And so we actually don't use CTDBs because we had to get this a while before CTDBs were around. There are also new features that were requested, such as streams, change notify, ACLs, to name a few. Steven touched on a few more in his talk. Bugs were uncovered. People requested higher performance. We implemented zero copy read and write, directory enumeration, added those to Samba as well. And then one of the killers is really the complex domain topologies. You get into these customers with 10, 20, 30,000 users, and the domains are incredibly complex. And we did a lot of work kind of in parallel with work that was being done upstream to make WinBind do a better job of interacting in these environments. So, SIFS is a drug. For us, the more we gave our customers, the more they wanted. And over time, it really exploded. And SIFS is now one of the, probably I would say even more popular than NFS for accessing our cluster. More enterprise customers, they use SIFS. When we started out, it was more research, but now SIFS is major. So coming with that, you get increasing levels of reliability and quality that are expected and required by the customers. And this led to significant in-house development of Samba. We ended up with huge diffs, and when you combine that with merging, it is painful. So these are kind of the merge steps we've taken over time, starting with 2.4 to 3.9, and then we went to 3.11 shortly after, then a big merge to 3.0.24, and the most recent merge, which we just completed, to 3.4. Merges take time, a lot of time, and oftentimes it requires rewriting code completely, and it doesn't just cleanly apply. Yeah, Volker?
If you do that rewrite, I would assume that you have tweaks to specific customer bugs in your code that you need to port forward.
Right.
Do you have a strategy to reproduce these bugs against the newer versions, or didn't you take care of that?
Yeah, I mean, our changes fell into kind of two different categories. We have the changes that were to implement new features and take advantage of custom parts of our file system. And then we had the bug fixes. So yeah, in the process of going through the diffs each time and applying them, we would go through the bug fixes as well and apply those. But we did the best job we could to actually go through and try and reproduce those on the new versions. But yeah, that's one of the problems, is that new bugs, the next point here, new bugs are always introduced when you do these types of merges. And there's no way around it. Things fall through the cracks, and that's what happens.
Existing bugs were often a manual regression after the merge of all existing bugs. So manually regressing every bug every time was also a growing problem.
Right. The other problem with this strategy is merges only get more difficult over time because you write more code and the code changes more underneath you, and you have to apply more code to more challenging releases. And then it really just did become apparent that we needed to get out of the merge business. So that brings us to our new Samba philosophy. So we considered a few alternatives. One is continue with the current merge strategy, which I think is pretty obvious we didn't want to do. There's also writing our own SIF stack. Some of our competitors, NetApp, EMC, and Sun, have all done this. There's certain customer perception. When people are running against NetApp, they say, oh, NetApp has a native SIF stack. It works just like Windows. It's great. And then when they see a bug with us, they say, oh, you're running Samba. That's free software that's not as good. And I mean, it's tough, but that's the reality of it. We run into customers who have that perception. So I mean, these were very real things we considered. And the third option is to actively participate in the Samba community. And the main piece of that is upstreaming our code. And by investing in Samba for the future, what that allows us to do is hopefully over time change the customer perception. By trying to make Samba better, we can't necessarily change the way customers perceive Samba in our system, but we can make it run bug free, and then they don't have to worry about the fact that it's not native. So proprietary free software. What does that mean? Well, our code was available, but it was available in a 35,000 line diff, and it's pretty much not consumable by anybody. The diff applied to an older release, and there's really just, it wasn't particularly useful to anyone. Samba's GPL, so we had to make the code available, which is fine, but we really came to the realization there's nothing to hide. We don't have anything in Samba that is proprietary information. Now, we do have a clustered file system, which I can give you a reasonably confident remark that I doubt that will ever be upstreamed to FreeBSD, but Samba, really, it's no big deal for us. And in fact, we'd rather upstream everything we can because it's better for us, the community, and our customers if we get that code out there, exercised by more people, and just generally improved. So investing in open source, a big piece of this is increasing the quality. When you have both parties working on it, we get the added benefit of not just our internal developers trying to make it better, but also community, the Samba community making it better. And likewise, the Samba community gets the added benefit of our developers as well. And this applies for bug fixes and new features, but another aspect of it is really the QA. We've got a QA department in-house with a few people that are dedicated to SIFs. So they do a really good job and find lots of bugs, and it allows us to take those resources and apply them and basically push that work back up to the community, because we have to fix them anyway, so we might as well help everyone out. At the same time, our code gets tested. I know at least a few people have fixed a few bugs in code that we've written, and that's great. And really, it adds more usage to the code. It gets stressed, and bugs are found earlier. So that's kind of our philosophy of moving forward. Here's actually how we wanted to, or did, implement that. So some of the goals. We really want to eliminate the need for the costly future merges. That's the biggest thing. To do that, it was really about significantly reducing our diff against upstream. 35,000 lines is just not maintainable, and having it continue to grow, we just couldn't continue with. So the main thing was really figuring out an easy way to integrate the code upstream. And one answer, or one part of that, is there is no real easy way. But one of the things that made things really useful was make test. Make test is the ability, it's a make target that lets you basically run a whole battery of SMB torture tests, among a few other tests, against the code that you just wrote, which for us is huge. We haven't had this, and I know it's been available upstream for a while, and some of the work Yelmer did in the last few months, and I know some other people contributed, was to make this super easy to run, and everything just works. You run it, it runs all of SMB torture from Samba 4, and this has just been absolutely indispensable for us as we develop. It makes you have the ability to be much more confident about the code that you're writing, that you're not introducing new bugs. And now, it certainly doesn't cover everything, but it is so much better than nothing, which is what we were doing before. And then finally, one of the goals was really just to become better members of the open source community. We've been using the software for a long time. We really wanted to really just give back. So what we did is took our 35,000 changed lines, which a diff, like if you do a git diff and just pipe it to word count dash L, it's about a 55,000 line diff. It was bad, it was ugly. So we couldn't just work with this big diff and go through it one by one. What we actually did was go through and I went through our 2 years of patches and basically traced through all of our development branches and created a patch stack that contained exactly 425 separate patches. So I had the entire history of everything we'd done for the last 2 years, and what I did was actually break them into categories, and so that way we had 15 patches to implement our create file, another 20 patches for OpLocks, and so on and so forth. And that really helped to make it easier to quantify exactly how much work we had in front of us and also make sure things didn't get lost in the process. So at the beginning, and this even goes back to before we started our merge, was submitting some initial patches upstream. You can't really just start merging major features without getting your feet wet, building hopefully a little bit of credibility. So it started in the last few years, but there's really a big focus on it for us in the few months leading up to the merge of really spending some extra time to generalize any bug fixes we had that could go upstream and taking the extra few hours to do that and submit them upstream and respond to the comments that come back and rework the patches. And some of the other things we did were just kind of some small little code cleanup projects that they were nice to have, but we didn't really need to do them. It's just kind of ways to get patches upstream and get involved. And a lot of it's also has just been building relationships with the Samba community on Samba Technical, on IRC, and also just at conferences. So Stephen and I did both become Samba members late last year, and this for us was very nice because it coincided roughly with about when we were starting the work on our merge. And we informed a few people. You may remember when we informed you that we were going to be working on submitting a battery of patches to Samba Technical with the intention of upstreaming everything we've done since the company started. And about a week after that, we were approached and said, hey, why don't you guys just commit those yourself? You know, you don't have to be a Samba team member to contribute to Samba, and especially with Git, it makes it very easy to do distributed development, and you don't have to have commit access. But I do admit that it made things much easier for us and the process of going through this last merge. So, our final merge, that is the goal, and I think we're in a position that this was our last merge, so pretty excited about that. Really the strategy we had coming into this is that, you know, you can have patch stacks, but the best patch stack you can have is no patch stack. And for that, everything has to go upstream. And it was not super easy. We definitely took a lot more time this merge to go through, rewrite code, rework things, and put it upstream in a way that actually made sense. Modularization and APIs, which Stephen really highlighted, the VFS layer, the kernel OpLocks API, and then just general refactoring, taking out pieces of common functionality, helper functions, that was big. And what it allows when you have this modularity, and most of our system-specific code is in modules, is that everybody can contribute to the actual core of Samba and still have their independent system-independent code that makes it work on their system, like us. But it just it helps to really allow the core to be stronger. And one of the decisions we made as well was to work directly from the upstream Git repository and set up an infrastructure to make it easy in our build system for our normal development to build just like we normally would on our in our environment, but actually point to the upstream repository to build that instead of our normal subversion tree, which was very nice because it just made for much more active development. Yeah.
I'd say about 4 or 5 times I had a patch and I said, there's no way, this is too custom to Islam, there's no way we can make this general. And every single time with some conversations and some deeper thought and deeper code reading, we figured out a way that it could be more applicable to people other than ourselves. So it definitely, I was pleasantly surprised at the number of ways we found to fit in our code that would be very useful to more people than just us with some thought.
Yeah, and adding to that, I remember the particular feature for me was getting our op locks in there was, like, I looked at the code and it was a nightmare. Like, there was no way. Like, so I really just started and I took a little chunk, fit it into the kernel op locks API, and still had a ton left to go. And literally piece by piece, I fit it in. But it was kind of a miracle that it made it in. But it did. So, you know, I'm glad that it's in there. Oh, yeah, Volker.
How to argue internally to spend another day or two to make some patch really upstream compatible while your product runs with the ugly version?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
You got a customer problem.
Yeah.
You fix it the ugly way in some whatever intrusive way. You have this patch, you ship it to the customer, customer's happy. So now, bug by bug, you need to argue, wait a second, this is not upstreamable because it has these if-def isolon somewhere deep inside open.c. I need to abstract this away. This takes a day, a week, whatever. How do you get that through internally, your company to spend that effort?
Okay, yeah, I follow. So before, when we were based off 3024, this was very difficult. Because the only way we could really do this was through like if-defs or something, which is not really an acceptable and maintainable way to put code upstream. So going forward, having almost all of our code in our module, in our 1FS module, it allows us to basically do whatever we want down there without, some of you may have seen some of the less than beautiful customer hacks that are contained to our module, but it allows us to put the things down there that are ugly and should not be in upstream Samba, but they're still in upstream Samba, they're just in our module. So to be honest, it's kind of new ground we're blazing. There are certainly going to be patches that we do a quick customer fix for, and we might end up adding to our patch stack for that reason or need to spend time reworking it. But I'm hoping with this new, more modular system that it will be less of an issue. So,
Volker, I'd add also, one, we had good management that recognized that this, in the long term, would be less pain. And then a little bit of stubbornness on Tim and I's part saying, no, we're going to do it the right way. No, I need to. This needs 2 days. This can't be done in less than 2 days. So.
Yeah, that's true. And there's an element of fun, small element of fun in telling somebody, no, this code isn't upstreamable. Why don't you go back and do it this way? Because there's other people than just Steven and I that work on Samba and do SIFS related work. So, and if you watched repository in the commit mail, you probably saw commits from other people that we pushed as well. So another big piece was getting an isolon build machine in the build farm. This was very helpful as we went through the process to basically make sure everything was working at all times, or at least working as well as we could estimate from the build farm. But if you're not familiar with it, it runs make test over and over again on every new build that it can, as fast as on every new commit that it can, so long as your machine is fast enough to keep up. And yeah, I see this as a real continued benefit going forward. One of the initial challenges, and it continues to be an ongoing challenge, is that for code to be in our repository, it has to build warning free. That's just kind of an internal thing. So our build farm machine actually has -WAR enabled to build warning free. And well, there aren't a lot of warnings in Samba, but there are a decent amount, especially when code goes through the Frankie process coming from Samba 4 to Samba 3 or into the shared directory. Oftentimes warnings get introduced. So getting the build warning free turned out to actually be kind of a constant amount of work throughout the merge. And
I've been there for years.
Yeah. Eventually, it would be nice to get some sort of error, like dash W error added to the developer configure flags. But you know, we'll see going forward. I think that would at least make my life easier. And we did a few small improvements to make test. We added the ability to separate out the share directory that you actually run the test against from the TDB directory, because we need to be running our tests against our shared file system versus our TDBs, which can't be on the clustered file system. And we also added the ability to add a custom configuration file so you can enable certain things during the make test for us, our OneFS module. Right, so our actual implementation of going through and doing the merge, there were a few of us working on it. We pretty much each took one feature at a time, sat down, as Steven was talking about, just thought, hammered it out, had some discussions, and really just figured out how to rewrite it. And it pretty much was all complete rewrites of everything we had done. There were a few pieces that kind of we got, woohoo, for free. But now most of it was a full rewrite. So the process we kind of went through was first you code it up, do an internal review, send it out for review, get feedback, make changes, improve it. Once we did that, then sending out Samba Technical, getting feedback, making changes, and then finally actually pushing it upstream. And then what we did in the process of doing this was actually do regular refreshes from the upstream Git repository into our Subversion repository. And what this allowed is to actually have our build machine pick up the latest code drops and actually build it and let QA start testing it. So QA was kind of delayed, like probably refreshed about every week and a half or two, depending on where we were in the cycle. But it allowed QA to kind of keep up to date, test our most recent code, even though we weren't committing directly to Subversion. So this was actually pretty nice. So finally, it all worked out. And so going forward, some of the things that we are interested in are just really improving the quality of the upstream releases. There's kind of a few specific things that come along with that. One of them is the build system, just real practical. Mets, I don't owe him a beer because he doesn't drink beer, but I owe him something because he did a real solid and got V3.4 test added to the build farm, which is the next future release, which in our opinion is very important to be building in the build farm, because that's the release we're trying to stabilize and get ready to ship. And internally, we're stabilizing it and getting it ready to ship. So getting it in the build farm now rather than after it ships is actually very nice. So improvements there, and our main focus is really stabilizing the code base that is in V3.4, because that's what we're shipping. And that's our focus right now internally. We're spending our time fixing bugs, so we would love to have the upstream code stabilize in sync with us. So this is nice, because now that our code's upstream, we can focus on making improvements to Samba, adding new features, and better performance. We really have already had some discussions about enhancing architecture. And yeah, I think it opens the door to work on merges, or to stop working on merges and work on something else. Because if anyone's done a big merge, it's really not a fun way to spend time. You spend potentially months working on getting something to work the same way it used to, which I don't know about you guys, but I don't really like doing. So practically now, we're no longer developing directly off of the upstream Git because we've got it in our internal Subversion tree, and we're committing directly to Subversion now just because we're actually doing bug fixing and trying to get a release out the door. So we're still kind of defining what the process is going to look like, or is looking like as far as getting the work we're doing internally in our internal tree and getting that actually upstream. So when we finished the merge, we came out after the whole thing with only one patch in our patch stack, which we were pretty pleased with. And the actual patch, what's that? Yes, and the patch was not particularly large. It was probably like, I don't know, less than 50 lines. And we actually did push it upstream at one point and later reverted it. But that's not even that big of a deal because it was kind of a customer thing anyway. And the fact that we only had one small patch at the end was exceeded my expectations. So I was very happy about that. But yeah, so what we're going to do going forward is, as far as pushing our patches up and pulling bug fixes down, still working on defining the best way to do that, using a little bit of Git repository magic to help ease things and keep track of our patches. This has been nice. Git Rebase can automatically take out patches that have already been pushed upstream, which is very useful. And so, ideally, we'd like to be able to easily do future refreshes from upstream with pretty much very little work on our hands. Having a small patch stack or no patch stack is really, it makes it almost a free operation. You just pull in the code and start testing it. And with the build farm running the code all the time, we can at least know it's passing all of the base tests, which is nice. So that's kind of where we're at. We've, in the process of the last month or two, fixing bugs internally and focusing on what our QA department has found. We unfortunately have gone up from one patch to a few more, and part of that's just the delay time between somebody fixing it and actually getting it upstream. And part of it is kind of goes back to what Volker said, where it was fixed in a way that is not the best way to go upstream, and it needs a little reworking. And so we already have a few patches like that. But yeah, that's pretty much where we're at right now, and we're just kind of moving forward from here. So kind of just closed off, kind of went over really the problem, our proposed solution, how we implemented it. And I would say it was a success. And kind of advice to anyone else who might be doing this or thinking about doing it, you really pay a cost either way. If you're gonna go with the whole patch management, trying to do merges, you know, it's not as expensive when you are actually writing the code the first time. You don't have to push it upstream, don't have to do any of that, but you have to do merges. On the other hand, you do pay a cost because when you're pushing stuff upstream, there is more work involved. There's no way around that. You have competing requirements of what you need internally from your to address the needs of your customers, and fix the bugs you have, which may not align perfectly with upstream. You may get feedback saying, no, this is bad, you shouldn't do this, or you can't do this and have this be upstream. And you have to go back and redo some things. So there is a cost there, but we definitely believe that upstream has, pushing things upstream, having the upstream interaction has many more benefits that outweigh the costs. And we also believe the cost is lower. So it really just, it leads to higher quality code and allows us to focus on the things we actually want to work on rather than the things that are boring and error prone and just not fun. So with that, I'll open it up to questions, if there are any.
I have to admit that you guys are kind of the poster child for doing this right. So I wondered if you were planning to give this talk anywhere, say like the O'Reilly Open Source Conference in San Jose, or you could take this on the road and probably, you know, do a bunch of conferences around the US or the world if you wanted to on this. I just thought I'd let you know.
Well, I should put you in contact with my boss. That sounds excellent. All right.
No more questions or comments?
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Oh, okay. Thank you.